This is The Conversation. It's a podcast that goes behind the scenes and between the lines of the contemporary art worlds and blockchain and cryptocurrency, among other things. Welcome to the show. I am Michael Shaw. This is episode 293 with Mitchell Chan. He is a Toronto-based artist working in sculpture and, more recently, blockchain, over the last several years, actually. In fact, a lot of what we talk about is his piece, which is a digital iteration or interpretation of the immortal Eve Klein's Zones of Immaterial Pictorial Sensibility. So Mitchell Chan's is the Digital Zones of Immaterial Pictorial Sensibility. You will hear about that, but also so much more. The website for this show is theconversationpod.com, where I do advise you to go check out some images, including Mitchell's Something Something, which is a collision of two water vapor clouds in a space, as well as a pretty wild sculpture and installation, and the certificate from his Digital Zones of Immaterial Pictorial Sensibility. And also, if you haven't seen this image ever, or even if you haven't seen it in a while, the image of Eve Klein leaping from a second floor window, apparently to the street, is something else. I hadn't seen it in a while, and it's not like I remembered. So go check that out as well. So what are we going to talk about before we talk a little bit more about... I will just quickly say that one of the things you'll be getting from this conversation is a much wider view and context to this NFT, non-fungible token phenomenon that is going on, because Mitchell has been in this space, that is to say blockchain and cryptocurrency, for at least 5 years. And so to him, it's all arriving as he's been working on it for a while. All right, what are we going to talk about before we talk about that? I want to tell you a few things, if you can bear with me. Thank you. I have a newly designed, redone website, which I would very much appreciate it. Not only if you check out, but if you go down to the bottom of the page, this is the main reason I had it redone, you can sign up and become part of the newsletter in which I will bombard you with emails 5 times a day. No, that's sarcasm. I will probably only send out maybe a couple times a year, something like that, but it'll be good to have you be part of that team/community as separate from the podcast one. So the website that I'm referring to is Michael Shaw Studio. That's MICHAELSHAW studio.com. And again, just bop down to the bottom, put your email in there, and you will be added to the list. Thank you very much in advance. I want to tell you also about the new direction of this podcast. I've mentioned it before, but I'm going to continue to mention it. It's something that is only in the planning phases still, but just maybe the very beginnings of some planning about what's going to come first in that regard. I want to set you up for, you know, sort of give you some time to process it in advance, just in case, A, we have to skip a week or two or an episode or two because it's taking a while, and B, because I want you to be prepared for this new format, which will not have a guest at this juncture. So just putting that out there. And one other thing I want to tell you about is a movie that I saw earlier in the week that I definitely recommend. It's called The Man Who Sold His Skin. It's definitely a contemporary art world focused movie. It is, in fact, inspired by Wim Delvoye, the Belgian artist's piece from, I think, 2006 to 2008, in which he tattooed the back of a former tattoo parlor owner, and they came to an agreement in which many times a year this tattoo parlor owner, Tim Steiner, would sit in galleries as a living exhibition. So there's definitely a parallel in the movie, although it has a much more involved and intense, and, you know, Syria is involved, fleeing Syria. So that'll give you a little bit more of an idea of what the movie is about, but highly recommend. It is on Hulu. And before I tell you more about Mitchell Chan, just before we jump in, I do want to remind you that this is a listener-supported show, and thank you so much to those of you who have recently pledged your support via Patreon, and to those of you who have been doing it for years. So thank you so much. If you would like to join them, just go to theconversationpod.com/support. You can find the Patreon link there. You can also support via Venmo, PayPal, and good old-fashioned check. So thank you in advance. You can support the show non-financially as well by leaving a great review on the Apple Podcast page or Stitcher, or if you listen elsewhere, you can spread the word. You can follow us on Instagram at Artist Podcast. You can follow me at Michael Shaw Art. You can share your thoughts. Oh, and one other thing, going back to this new direction of the podcast that I forgot to mention. I would love some legal feedback or advice. I presume none of you are lawyers listening to the show, maybe one of you. If you have a friend or loved one who is a lawyer who knows anything about copyright law, particularly related to podcasts, I would love 5 minutes of pro bono or free advice, 5-10 minutes tops. If you could put me in touch, I would really appreciate it. So, all right. So quickly about Mitchell Chan. He did, as I said, this piece, The Digital Zones of Immaterial Pictorial Sensibility, inspired by Yves Klein's original non-digital version from the late 50s, which he performed then and I believe into the early 60s. It's fascinating stuff. I mean, if you're not familiar with what Yves Klein did at that time, which I wasn't, you'll learn a lot. And it's also very interesting to think about in a digital context and Mitchell's work in this piece and elsewhere really sort of gives a much more thorough understanding of the abstraction that is blockchain and the idea of the receipt being the thing or the certificate being the thing. So we get into that and we eventually, towards the end, get into this NFT phenomenon, you know, given this wider context, because this piece that Mitchell did, The Digital Zones of Immaterial Pictorial Sensibility, goes back to 2017. So I think that's about it. Thank you very much for being here. Do let us know what you think of the show. And if you want to contribute in any way, shape, or form to this new format that we are working towards, we would definitely appreciate your contribution. So definitely reach out. Hope you're doing well. Hope you have, if you haven't gotten vaccine number 2, as I did last week, you are very close and you're staying healthy. And I will talk to you in a couple of weeks. Until then, stay healthy and be well. Ciao for now. What was your initial exposure to Yves Klein, and did you actually like do some papers on him, you know, more than the average graduate or art student did?
No, I would say no more than the average art student did. I was familiar with his work, of course, him being part of the canon and, you know, the other Fluxus artists with whom he was associated being part of the canon and some that you study at school. But Yves Klein was the artist that I ended up being drawn to as I was exploring more about cryptocurrency and the ways that it represented a dematerialization of value. And, you know, I was thinking, well, you know, what would art have to say about this? And I was researching it, I just kept coming back to Yves Klein. And that's when I did the deep dive on his life and works.
Because I asked that partially because, and I don't know how, you know, unusual this is or how behind or sort of undereducated I am about him, but I feel like I'm representative in that my association with him is simply threefold. One, the blue paintings, right? The monochrome blue paintings. Two, the paintings he did where he had women, you know, sort of dip into paint and then put them onto the paper or canvas, right? Kind of a classic image. And then three, the image of him doing a swan dive or, you know, dive out a window looking like he's heading towards the street, right? So
yeah, those are the big ones, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
And it's funny because the last two that you mentioned, I mean, I consider, I know that they're sort of related in his career and in his investigations, but to me, they feel a little bit more like Klein the Showman.
Right.
But it is in the blues, in the blue monochromes that I think were, they represent that drive towards the immaterial. And by that, I guess I mean the drive to make something that is both more and less than a painting.
Mm-hmm.
And I like all the work that I, the work of his that I was most interested in are the works that fit into that narrative, of which I think the blue monochromes are like the best known example.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, for me, where those blue monochromes come from are like his quest to, I mean, I think of it as a continuation, like an extension of like, you know, a minimalist or maybe like suprematist drive to free the artwork from any representation.
Mm-hmm,
right.
Mm-hmm.
You know, one of the things that I sort of wrote about, you know, recently was, you know, thinking about Klein's blue canvases in relation to, say, like Malevich's Black Square,
mm-hmm.
right? Where like Malevich's Black Square was this, you know, attempt to completely remove painting from any sort of like naturalistic representation. It is in some ways, I think, like, you know, art for art's sake, although, you know, that's sort of a politically like loaded term. But it's that complete refusal for an artwork to be anything other than an artwork, right?
Right.
And for me, like what Klein is doing with those blue monochromes is he's taking it a step further. He doesn't want it to be even a painting. And I think that there are two like technical things. Like he actually employs technology to do this. You know, the one technology that he's most famous for is his own patented pigment of blue, International Klein Blue, right? Which is like, I mean, it's an incredible technology if you want to think about it like that. You know, he has this paint that is so flat that it, like, that the picture plane dissolves, right? If you stare at it, you can't really tell where the canvas is once you stare at it long enough. And it's an important, and like that's a very important, like the technology has very important subtlety to it. If he'd have used a paint that had any sort of gloss to it, right?
Right.
You would get these specular highlights. That picture plane would become visible to you, that part where your world ends and the world of the painting begins, that would be evident. But with complete flatness, you don't have that, right? And the other technological thing that he does, this is like a minor technology, but it's like a technical thing nonetheless, right, is he would try to mount the painting off the wall by a few inches with these brackets. And that's emphasizing that thing. Where does the painting begin? He just doesn't want it to be a painting, right? He wants it to be something else. He wants it to be pure experience,
mm-hmm.
right? And so I consider that, you know, in evolution of the idea that I'd mentioned previously. And this idea of dematerialization, like he was, you know, playing around with it in other aspects of his career as well. Like around the time, like I think it was around like 1958, he was designing, he had these like collaborations with architects. He wanted to design something he called an architecture of air, where like the building would be just like gusts of wind and air and like pillars of fire that would somehow protect you like from the elements, right?
Mm.
And it was all like kind of ridiculous, but he's really invested in making things that are immaterial, believing that that's a pure sensation.
Right. Do you know if he himself actually developed the technology for the matte blue, or did he have a lot of one or several collaborators to, or you know, somebody he outsourced that to?
Yeah, you know what? I actually don't know that, and I probably should look that up, whether it was him or a sort of scientist. I just know
right.
that it is, you know, it's his name on the patent, which
sure.
I guess is what matters, right?
Does that, now talking about it now, does not bring to mind the blackest black that the sculptor whose name is eluding me. But
Anish
I'm sure
Kapoor.
Yeah, Anish Kapoor, who copyrighted. Is it the same thing? He didn't patent it, obviously, so he copyrighted it, which is a different thing.
Yeah, didn't he buy like the exclusive rights?
The rights to it,
no,
something
but I think
like
it
that.
Was like, but yeah, but I think it's like a narrow application of those rights. Like he's the only artist who's allowed to use it in an artwork. It is something like that, which I mean, the sort of like, yeah, the like atomization of those rights. It does make it feel a little bit different for sure.
Can you imagine going to a dinner party where Anish Kapoor is as an artist and not being like a little, having a bit of a grudge at the very least towards him? You know, do you think he's been picking up a lot of grudges going around?
Yeah, I you know what? I believe that he has. I've definitely seen some eye rolling about it. It's a little bit of a flex, a little bit of a power move. Maybe not in the cool way either.
No, it's so uncool. It's just like corporate. Anyway, I'm glad to know all that. But I think this is a nice sort of setting the table for what was really revolutionary, you know, or progressive or breakthrough of him. Do you want to talk about the void that he created?
Yeah, let's talk about it. Because, you know, as you pointed out, it's probably not one of his three best known works.
No.
But to me, I mean, it's absolutely magnificent. And I think, you know, it's also a piece that is like very much in that school of conceptualism that is sort of like easy to mock now because it's very easy to do something like it, I think, without putting the requisite amount of faith in it and without having like an entire career worth of exploration come to bear on it. But anyway, so this is what happened. All right. So this was the void, which would later become known as the zones of immaterial pictorial sensibility.
Mm-hmm.
So these were first exhibited in 1958 at Galerie Iris Claire on 3 Rue des Beaux-Arts in Paris. And, you know, so Klein is already a sensation at this point, you know, largely because of his blue monochromes. So there is apparently like a lineup to get into this fairly small, like storefront gallery. And like, according to Klein's own notes, the like French Republican Guard is there to like keep order because there's such a crowd stirring. So people are lined up down the street, and as they approach the gallery, the windows have been blocked off by blue curtains, and there's another blue curtain that marks the entranceway. And when you finally get in, you receive a celebratory cocktail, and it's a blue cocktail. It's a mixture of Cointreau and blue methylene. And people would enter the gallery, and there was nothing. There's nothing in there. In fact, Klein had even repainted the gallery white just to make sure there would be nothing in there, no markings, right? And his claim was that this was an empty space that was imbued with the sensibility of the color blue. So as far as Klein is concerned, right, this is the continuation of his exploration, right? Like, I had mentioned that, you know, the blue monochrome paintings, he was always trying to make something that was not a painting. He was trying to just directly take the viewer to a different place, take the viewer to the sensation of this infinitely deep blue, right? Mm. And so with this exhibition, The Void, he's taken the final step and removed everything. And he says, there's just the sensibility, the idea of it is there. His exact words were he hopes to, like, and I quote, literally impregnate viewers with the sensibility of the color blue. And, I mean, this is an audacious claim, and it feels like a scam. Like, you know, if I saw, like, a grad student do this now, I'd be like, eh, nice try, kid. But, you know, when I'd read about it, and when I would just take into account his entire career, it does seem like the logical next step, this complete dematerialization of the work of art, and that an artist's entire history, their force of will could create a consensus that this sensibility was there and it existed, right? So, but I think that where Klein became, like, was an absolute genius about it. It was not just having the empty gallery and saying, okay, this space contains an idea. And then he reinforces that idea of the immateriality of the artwork by also thinking about how this artwork would be owned, right? Not just how it would be viewed, but he understands that ownership is a part of the experience of artwork. So he actually comes up with a sort of like a very kind of like a Byzantine set of rules for how it is that this artwork should be purchased, right, and traded. And he says that these works are for sale, these invisible artworks that are just the sensation of the color blue, mm-hmm. you can buy them. But to contrast the immateriality of the artwork, he wants like the first level of ownership to be conferred through only the most material of currencies. So he insists that the works must be purchased for pure gold. Okay?
Right.
Pure gold. That's it. Won't take money. He won't take a franc.
Right.
Won't take a dollar. He's going to take gold. And people did it. Okay? I think seven people bought these invisible artworks for pure gold. Mm-hmm. And what they got in exchange was a receipt. They're very nice receipts. I love mm-hmm. a nice receipt. These are beautiful receipts. They say, received against 20 grams of gold, one zone of immaterial pictorial sensibility. So you get this receipt, you've transferred your gold, and now you have this. And I'm going to use this word. I think it'll come up later in our conversation. You get a token, a paper token. You might even say that token is non-fungible because it denotes ownership of one particular invisible artwork, but not another one. So you have this token that says you own it. And I mean, already there's a kind of weird commodification going on, right? You have a document that confers legal ownership over an invisible artwork. You also have this piece of paper, which you could kind of say is like an artwork in and of itself, because like this token denotes like a participation in the artwork. And surely, like as a commodity, if you have one of these paper tokens right now, I mean, you could probably sell it at auction for a good amount of money.
Mm-hmm.
Even though the receipt is not the artwork, right? The invisible zone of air, of sensibility is the artwork, but that token would be its own commodity, would be worth something. But Klein understands one step further that there is a difference between legal ownership of an artwork as commodity and a true and pure ownership of an artwork. And he says that to really own an artwork, if you really own an artwork, particularly this artwork, which he says is just a sensibility, a feeling, all right, that means that it becomes a part of you, right? And it can't be severed from you. And so he says that to do this, to have this true kind of spiritual ownership of the artwork, you have to participate in a ritual. And you would go and meet Eve Klein at the River Seine, and three people did this. And you'd bring your paper receipt, that paper token, and you burn it. And then you lose that commodity that you could probably sell at the auction house right now for a lot of money. And he throws half of his gold in the river. Only half. Okay, but he throws half of his gold in the river. And with that ritual, the true like sensibility, that idea is like conferred to you. And it is part of you wholly and intrinsically. And there were three people who did this, and the notes that we have from at least one of them say that it was an incredibly powerful experience. And that was, and those were the zones of immaterial pictorial sensibility.
Let me just clarify something. So one half of the gold gets thrown in the Seine, right? What happens with the other half? Does somebody get that?
He keeps it.
He keeps it, and he cashes it in, and that's how he funds his future projects.
Keeps it, he cashes it in, or presumably they may also have been turned into, whether like literally or sort of just symbolically, turned into another series of pieces that he did of gold monochromes. And mm-hmm. these were just, you know, canvases that were covered in gold leaf.
Right. I want to back up before we mm-hmm. maybe look more at the void. He was obviously a great salesperson. Presumably, mm-hmm. I would imagine he had the cult of personality and had a lot of charisma. Do you know if you can verify any of those three things?
I would say evidence suggests that's very much the case. I mean, when you think about the fact that this exhibition, where there are apparently thousands of people lined up, is happening on his 30th birthday.
Right.
And I think it's fair to assume that to achieve that degree of notoriety before your 30th birthday, yes, he was certainly, like, you know, I think I've described him as a showman. He's certainly a charismatic figure.
Now, let's also talk about some of the reactions, because they range from frustration, right, or anger even, mm-hmm. to mm-hmm. One person passed out. Is that what happened?
I don't know. I don't have documentation of that. So I can't say that for certain. Of course, now in history, like, what has been recorded, and certainly, like, what I've read are the positive reactions, because that is sort of, you know, what ends up in the Eve Klein, like, you know, monographs that
right.
I'm reading. You know, like, Albert Camus left a note at the exhibition, and he wrote, "With the void, full powers," as a way of congratulating Eve Klein. But
right.
I certainly imagine that many of the visitors to the exhibition would have been puzzled, to put it lightly. But that's just me, you know, that's just me assuming, you know, perhaps the art-going crowd of 1958 was more complex than what I see here in 2021.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it's hard to know. I mean, there was, you know, there was Duchamp, right, who was sort of in that lineage, I think, of revolutionary work. But how much of what he did was in Europe? And it was more in New York, from mm-hmm. what I recall. Anyway, I mean, you're right. It's really hard to speculate. You would have to imagine. I mean, let's just project for a second, if nothing else, that there are some people who go in and they see this, you know, this emptiness, and they go, "What the fuck?" You know, and they feel like they've, you know, they've really sort of been punked. You know, or for mm-hmm. lack of a better term. But at the same time, you know, it's just like, I want to think this through with you. I think the waiting to get in and the hoopla, you know, and potentially the excitement around it, maybe that was a way for people to sort of project that anticipation into the piece. And, you know, so that a higher percentage of them were impressed or blown away, even, or, you know, what have you. What are your pontifications about that?
Well, like, those people were made credulous, and I think yes, and, like, there's a you know, I've said the word ritual a few times, right?
Yeah.
And so Klein really understands, right? And we've both said the word charisma a few times, and, you know, what we're talking about is sort of setting the scene, right? And because you can't just sort of, like, cold call someone and say, "Sensibility of color blue, go," right?
Right.
Like, there's a buildup to this. And so, you know, like at the gallery, like I said, there's the blue curtain, all right?
Yeah,
there's,
yeah.
like, the blue doorway, there's the blue right. cocktail. And then, right, so it's like you're primed for it.
Right.
And then there's yeah. the pulling of the rug out from under you,
yeah.
right? And with the idea that, okay, these things are taken from you, now there should be only the sensibility. But the artist, you know, charisma, his career, are, like, integral to manufacturing that belief, right?
Right?
And, I mean, that's another theme that I come back to a lot in my own work and in my own thinking about art. I think a lot about I think a lot about like an Andrea Fraser quote that I'm fond of taking out of context and applying my own baggage to, uh-huh. right? Who said, you know, to paraphrase, that essentially like that what we produce in the art world is belief, right? That is what we do, right? And that belief is produced by divisions of labor within the art world, right? The artist does some of it, the gallerist does some of it, the curator does some of it, the market does some of it, right? Manufactures that belief, and that's right. really, you know, that's what we're making here. And so, yes, Klein's charisma and his career work to date, I think, have to come together to do that.
Yeah.
And then there is a sort of consensus about his authority to make an immaterial sensation of the color blue, right? Mm-hmm. But, you know, I'd be a part of this consensus. I am credulous. I believe in the project.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Hmm. It's kind of fun to think about. I mean, I think I have a bit of a knee-jerk reaction that's usually negative towards, you know, a lot of art history that is pretty played out in education and, you know, in our own educational experiences to some extent. But I think this one is under-taught, you know, at least from my experience. I don't know if you know anything beyond, you know, our experiences, but... as we talk about it more, I appreciate trying to speculate, you know, what it was like. I was thinking about what he might be doing as people are coming into the space. He's like ready to sort of spout his spiel, you know, or if he's more like trying to sort of stand back and, you know, kind of get out of his own way. You know what I mean? And it's also interesting to kind of think about, as you alluded to earlier, like the complex level of sophistication of people at that time, you know, because there were sort of precedents, but in other ways, there were no precedents.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, he exhibited these pieces multiple times later, and he did take different approaches
right.
to it, almost like he was experimenting with the correct presentation. And so there were... there was at least one exhibition that I know about, you know, where he loudly declared, I hope I get the quote right. He said, "First there is nothing, then there is a deep nothing, then there is a deep blue." And he loudly declares that. And that's it, right? That's him, you know, saying his spiel, sort of like you hypothesize. And then I know there were other exhibitions where he said, "Just write in the catalog that it's here," you know, and that was it. You know, just like, there were some exhibitions where he had, a certain area like marked off in tape to say that, you know, this is where the zone is. This is the zone of immaterial pictorial sensibility. There were exhibitions where he did not do that. So he wasn't really consistent with this. And you know, you can read into that what you will, whether that was him experimenting with the format, with exactly how much presence he had to have, how much presence or suggestion like of presence the artwork had to have. I'm not sure. But yeah, he did. He messed with it.
So now, cut to 5 years ago, right?
Mm-hmm.
Mitchell Chan is thinking about the blockchain and cryptocurrency. And then you come across Eve Klein and this Void piece that he did. And long story short, you know, you can give me, of course, a much better revised version, but you aim to create a digital version of this, a digital zone of immaterial pictorial sensibility. How would you like to put that?
I think you put it pretty well. And I, 'cause that was the title of the piece, was a digital zone of immaterial pictorial sensibility.
Mm-hmm.
I'm gonna get tired of saying that over and over again.
you can just call it the zones.
Yeah, or I'll call this one the digital zone. And
right.
So I mean, here's where I was. I was in a place in my career where I'd just come off. I mean, what was to that point probably my most, you know, successful exhibition, and I was also very interested in dematerializing artworks, right? But I was coming at it from a very, very different place from Eve Klein, or even from like a lot of the minimalists who were using dematerialization like as a way to make the artwork non-representative, like to make it just its own thing, right?
Right, right.
I became interested in using like, you know, what I called minimum viable materiality because I actually thought it was the best representational tool, right? And because I look around and I see a world where, you know, this level, you know, just beneath what we see, economic systems, social systems, systems of discourse, technological systems that frame our discourse and our economy, right? Those things are so immaterial, like they're invisible. And if you want to make artwork about them and represent them, I was like, well, I want to give it just that the minimum amount of visibility, because that is the best way to suggest that there is something invisible there, right, that is underpinning what we see all around us. So in 2016, yeah, my previous exhibition of this one, it was a sculpture. It was just two clouds of water vapor that collided over and over again. And to me, this was, you know, using nearly invisible materials was the best way to be representative. So then in 2017, I'm like, well, how can I go further? And I knew that I wanted to make an artwork that was going to be about, you know, I came into it with just a vague idea of making an artwork about economic systems. And I was like, well, how do I do that? I would like to make one. That would be the best way to make an artwork about that. And then I discovered cryptocurrencies, and I discovered Bitcoin, but especially I discovered Ethereum, which is a blockchain that was sort of like Bitcoin, except that while Bitcoin is a blockchain that can only really do addition and subtraction to add or subtract the Bitcoins from your wallet, Ethereum was a blockchain where you could write programs, which means you could write more complicated economic, like you could write your own kind of financial system in there. And so, you know, this was very, this was very interesting to me, but I was thinking, well, you know, this whole world of cryptocurrencies is so fascinating because, again, it is a system where, you know, value has been completely dematerialized, right? There is nothing, there's no gold standard that underwrites it. There is not even a paper thing that you can hold in your hand, obviously. So it is a value that is produced entirely just through consensus, right? There is an agreement that there is value there. There is, I would say, a sensibility of value. A Bitcoin is a digital zone of the sensibility of value, right? Like that's what it is. And then I started to think, okay, so if I'm going to make art on blockchain, what would it mean to, like, you know, own that? Like, what would it be? And I said, well, you know, an artwork that's on blockchain would have no physical aspect. I mean, you wouldn't even be able to point to a server somewhere that held it, right? Because a blockchain is completely decentralized. It exists on a lot of different computers, right? It has no fixed position. Some of those nodes can go online and offline or whatever. So this artwork would have no physical aspect, but it would be like transactable, right? It would be like there would be a token that you know, designates your ownership over it. And that idea of owning something completely invisible and immaterial, that's a weird idea. And then it just occurred to me that the best way to, you know, it occurred to me to employ that original Eve Klein project. And I'm like essentially using that project as like the material that communicates and like give some visibility to the real like idea that I'm trying to represent.
How would you encapsulate your interest or even obsession with immateriality? I mean, because that was something you mentioned kind of at the beginning of this, describing this project, and a question that popped up to me right away was, why are you interested in immateriality? I mean, is it in the sort of art historical sense, or is it connected more with the way you were describing, you know, value and how, you know, particularly in light of the beginning of cryptocurrency?
Yeah, with immaterial, like my interest in immateriality, it's actually like it's not in an art historical sense. You know, as I was saying, I think that most artists, like, immateriality is a sort of like, it's a kind of absolutism. Like, it's considered like an end point, right? This is the final. You know what Yves Klein said? He said, "I have solved the problematics of art." Right? Like, immateriality was a solution. Mm-hmm. It was an end point for me. So I'd never made a completely immaterial artwork. And I should make a distinction that I'm not talking about, like, digital artwork, which is, you know, you could say is immaterial, but I think there's still, like, almost all digital artwork still has a display value.
A visual component.
Exactly, right? Yeah. So let's say, like, you know, like you'd say that it has an optical property, even if it doesn't have a material one. And that's a totally different thing. Like, I don't think of digital work as being immaterial, right? Because it's still very optical. It's not a knock on it. I like it, but it has a different agenda.
Yeah.
And there are interesting conceptual things about it being, like, non-physical or made on a computer or existing on a server or whatever, but different conversation.
Right.
No, I've never thought of, as I've just tried to use, like, you know, make things that are sort of less and less visible. No, for me, it is a representational tool. It is not an endpoint. It's like this, like if you lived in a world where everything is white and you wanted to explain the color of black, the best thing you could do is make a painting that's gray, right? And so it's like, we live in this world and I am trying to make artworks that are about, like, an invisible world of systems, and the best way to do that is to make work that is almost kind of visible.
Yeah, but why are you interested in the invisible?
just as a tool. Like, I just felt like, because I guess when I say invisible, right? Like, I started off this project just wanting to make an artwork about capitalist systems, right? And these are the things that, and it, like, to call them invisible, like, that's a very, it's a simplistic designation, but
sure.
I'll do that as a kind of a shorthand, right?
Sure.
And it was just like the project that I did directly before the digital zones. It was called Something Something National Conversation. And it was essentially about the way that technology and social media, like, you know, it inframes our discourse. I mean, it shapes really what our discourse can be by virtue of its constraints, by virtue of the fact that you can only tweet 256 characters at a time, by virtue of the fact that it has to occur on, say, network television, where you need a soundbite to get ratings and things like that, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so these are the, right? And so it's just sort of like our discourse, the Twitter flame wars that we're having are very visible, right?
Mm-hmm.
We see those. But, you know, the structure that makes them the way they are is invisible, right? So make something halfway visible, and then you still have art that hints at the next layer down.
Mm-hmm. Well, if you were to categorize your interests sort of more broadly, you know, in a party talk maybe context, for lack of a better example, would you describe it as maybe a mix of, you know, this sort of interest in this invisible, you know, for lack of a better word, angle mixed with an interest in critiquing, you know, capitalism or investigating, you know, since you mentioned capitalist systems, you know what I mean? Is it like a mix of a couple or more things, you know what I mean? Or is it more, would you say it's more, no, it's actually more this?
I think you pretty much nailed it there.
Mm-hmm.
It's just looking at, you know what, I would say I make artworks about these things. You say, you know, capitalist systems, right? I make artworks about them because I'm, like, probably too dumb to understand them any other way, right?
Except right.
to, like, make something that I think is a representation of it.
Mm-hmm.
When you take an idea that is difficult to understand and amorphous, and I'll use the word again, invisible. Sometimes the only way that I can start to understand it is to, you know, take it in my hand, start to mold it, you know, put it in a different box, look at it a different way, right?
Yeah. So to get back to your digital zones then, you you set up your own Byzantine, right? set up rules, right? For the distributions or sale of the piece or iterations of the piece.
Yeah.
Let's cut to, how did that go? Did you anticipate or expect that you would sell a certain number of them, and how many did you sell?
Okay, so I didn't have a ton of expectations, mm-hmm. which was probably good. So what happened, right? So, right, there was a whole Byzantine system of purchasing the thing. I should say that, first of all, as part of, and I guess, you know, part of this system is just in the same way that Klein's, like, legitimacy was established through you know, throughout his career, and he... We know that he had a definite idea of the color blue that he was putting in his zones. Well, you know, I definitely wanted to put in the leg work, right? I didn't want to just translate something to code, and it'd be very difficult to communicate that. But I wrote a long essay, you know, that you've read. It was called The Blue Paper, and that was sort of a parody of, at the time, there was a lot of this stuff going on in the blockchain space. All these new startups were coming out of the woodworks. And they all had white papers. And these white papers would be like short documents that explained the proposition of what they were going to do on blockchain, right? So I made mm-hmm. my thing called the Blue Paper. And it was like this 33-page document that sort of like called my shot, said, this is what I'm trying to do. So, you know, I hope to achieve this as the background. It's also a little bit of like a blockchain explainer for art people mm-hmm. when I think it has right. some value like that as a document. And, you know, and I actually put a lot of time into thinking about what shade of blue would be in my digital zones mm-hmm. Because it couldn't be the same blue, because Eve Klein patented that and I did not want to run afoul his patent.
Right.
And so I traveled to Prince Edward Island and I looked at the different blues out there
yeah.
on the Gulf of St. Lawrence and the sky, et cetera. But then, so now what was this thing? So then when it was all ready, I wrote the smart contract and you could buy these tokens through the smart contract. You see now when people purchase NFTs, it's like you go to a website and you click buy, you know, and if your crypto wallet is connected, you buy it and there it is. Mine was not quite that simple. Like there wasn't really like a web page front end. You'd have to go to, like you'd have to use at that time, like a blockchain explorer. I think you could even do it on Etherscan at the time, which is a website that like just lets you look at what is in every smart contract. Or you could like use your own Ethereum node mm-hmm. to call the function to the contract and you could buy it. And then there's also another function on the contract that you can call to burn the token. And if you burn the token, then your record of ownership is removed from the ledger. So you no longer have ownership over it, and it does take half of the material currency you've paid to me for that token, and it throws that away. So you can burn your token, and you can destroy half of my ether, right? Half mm-hmm. of my cryptocurrency.
Mm-hmm.
So we had I gave a lecture at InterAccess in Toronto. Big shout out to InterAccess. I presented the blue paper. I read the blue paper. I talked about the relationship between cryptocurrency and conceptual art, and how I thought that, you know, conceptual art is actually a great like framework for understanding cryptocurrency, and how I thought that blockchain could really like provided a valuable new tool for creating conceptual art.
Mm-hmm.
And then there was an exhibition of the digital zone, which was just sort of like, I pulled out, you know, my laptop while everyone was there, and I called the function, and the very first IKB token, that's the symbol of the digital zone, was minted, you would say now, there at InterAccess. And then it was there, and that was the exhibition, and that's what we did. I ended up selling, to your question, I sold more than Eve Klein ever sold.
That's great. That's amazing.
So we sold more. I mean, they were cheap at the time, right? Yves Klein was selling his for 20 grams of gold. I was selling mine for 0.1 ether, which at that time would only be about $30. Today, it would be about $250.
Okay.
And then you know, nothing happened. I think maybe 20 of them sold or whatever. And then the contract just kind of sat there for a long time. No, the project really didn't make waves. Like, nobody cared.
Right, right.
And then this whatever has happened in the past, like, 4 months or whatever, like, has happened. And now, actually, all of the tokens on the first series are sold out. All 31 tokens in the first series sold out, and there's some interest, and people care, and that's pretty cool.
That's very cool, amazing. Do you know how many of the people who have, so 31 units sold of those 31? Do you know who any of them are?
Yeah, I actually know. Well, because like the first 20 were like my friends, right?
There's okay.
People, they showed up at the exhibition. It was nothing.
Right.
Over the period of time that I was making this, you know, I was talking to my friends, like, guys, I just like discovered this crypto thing, and like I think it's crazy. Like, I was like a full on crypto bro for like a year.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it was a really intense space. So they all had like, you know, Ethereum wallets at the time, and they bought it, and that was great. And then I know most of the people who have bought it since, and actually in like the sort of the last few were bought up by some actually like big crypto punks collectors. Because they're like, you know, actually very knowledgeable about the space and are really interested in tokens that were like created in like 2017, you know, as like, you know, sort of part of the history. And, you know, they're also like just like very curious, like they're just like sponges for information and learning about this stuff. So I think like the last few of them went to them. And then the coolest part, and this was like, and probably the best part, is like the contract just sat there. No one bought any for like a year and a half or whatever, which is fine. Like, you know, I did my presentation. I presented it again at Kent State University, like, you know, later on that year. And then all of a sudden, after like a year and a half of inactivity, there was like one person bought it. And I looked them up, right, because I could see their wallet address. And I said, hey, can I, like, talk to you? Like, why did you find this thing? And anyway, he was a person who, like, had curated, like, shows of crypto art, like, way before, you know, certainly I had made my crypto art project. And he introduced me to some of the people who, I mean, were into this, you know, even long before that, you know, some of whom, you know, like Ruth Catlow, who you've had on the show, right?
Yeah, yeah.
And so the absolute, and, you know, I was frankly quite embarrassed that I didn't know about their work when I was making the Digital Zones. But that's actually been the best part of the past, like, few months, was finding some of the other people who had incredible, incredible ideas in this space, even long before I had my little idea.
Mm-hmm. So, among other ways that we have come to NFTs, you know, the inevitable topic, right, is that the phenomenon swept up your project, and you were able to benefit that way. Is that fair?
Yeah, a little bit. And when I say like there's interest in the project, it's like I'm no Beeple, okay? Like,
of course not.
Getting my,
yeah,
like,
yeah, yeah.
You know,
right?
No one's going to give me $69 million. I think for, you know, IKB token zero. But when I say interest, it's just like, yeah, just connecting with some like-minded people who've been in the space for a long time, which is the primary benefit. But yes, this NFT craze it's been very like validating in a lot of ways. Because, I mean, really, like, the Digital Zones project is all about what does it mean to buy and sell an artwork when really what you're buying and selling is the token associated with the artwork, right? Like, you're just buying a token that points to the artwork. And, And this is like, and people are embracing it. And so at the time, like when I made the Digital Zone, like this was so, I mean, this was so exciting for me, right? Mm-hmm. And it still is, right? Even before like all like NFT boom happened, you know, I'm still working on making imaginary artworks. Like because to me, that's just very liberating.
Yeah.
And so, but one of the reasons why it's liberating, when it comes back to tokens, right? One of the big critiques of NFTs right now, people will say, well, the NFT is not like, it's not anything. It's not the artwork. It's just a receipt, right? It's literally just a text file in a certain format that points to a JPEG somewhere. People say the NFT is just a receipt. That's it. And my take is, yeah, that's amazing. Because that is the great promise for me. Because when the art, like if all the only thing that you have to sell is the receipt to the artwork, it means that the artwork can be anything, right? It means that it doesn't have to be like a painting that matches a collector's sofa. Right. All right. It doesn't have to be like something that hangs on a wall. And so it can be, look, at this moment in time, I don't think we're seeing a lot of NFT artists exploiting this, right? Which is fine. It's their prerogative. They can do whatever they want. I don't want to criticize anybody who's doing well in the space, but like, we're mostly selling like JPEGs and GIFs and like little video files and whatever. And that's fine. But the promise is that, I mean, think about what this means for conceptual art, right? That someone could like experience and appreciate a piece of conceptual art, and like you don't have to buy, you know, all of, let's say, like the, you know, performers who are going to like show up at your house and like throw like meat all over your floor and then dance in it, right? It's just a token of ownership of that idea. Like to me, it is incredibly liberating.
Right. It's a great benefit for that kind of conceptual art, that as far as giving it a foundation, you know, and a structure and a contract with which the artists can profit any future sales. Right. That's clear. I think it's a very big paradigm shift still for somebody like me and presumably a lot of people. To make that leap that you have made, that you've been making, you know, as a conceptual artist for a long time now, you know, for you to go, yes, the receipt, that's what's so exciting, right? That's kind of funny. I appreciate your enthusiasm, but it's still a little bit funny. And one more thing I want to say before I forget about this whole NFT phenomenon is, I feel like on one, this is my very limited take from the very little bit that I've read and listened to. On one hand, you have artists who are jumping on the bandwagon, you know, and just trying to take advantage of this phenomenon, right? Visually to something whereas they have no connection to this abstraction that, you know, this abstract ideal that you have embraced, right? So that's happening on one hand. And then on the other hand, I think as far as the collectors, you have people like the guy that you referred to, or a couple of people you referred to earlier, who are really passionate and have been longtime inhabitants of this space, you know, and really do get it, or at least they understand the value and it's like an investment for them in this new space.
Yes. And so I guess, okay, I'll rewind to this sort of beginning of you know, what you said about this being a difficult, you know, it's difficult
paradigm
for some
shift.
People to wrap their heads around, right? Yeah, it's a paradigm shift. But when you think about it, I mean, I started to think about it, and there actually are a lot of great artworks in history where I think that the reimagining of the receipt or like the selling of the receipt is like fundamental to the idea of the artwork, right? So one example that, you know, I think a lot of listeners would know would be Saul LeWitt with his wall drawings, right?
Right.
And the way that the Saul LeWitt wall drawing works, like famously, right, like the art history textbook line on Saul LeWitt is that, you know, he establish the idea that, you know, the artwork can just be the instructions for executing the artwork. And it's like actual execution or manifestation can happen independently of the artist. The artist is still the author of the artwork for having handed over those instructions, right?
Mm-hmm.
So if like a Sollowit wall drawing says, you know, make 50 random points and connect them all, you know, that the artwork takes a different form every time doesn't change the fact that it is his artwork. The artistic value of the artwork is in the idea, right? More so than in the execution, right? But how does he reinforce that? Well, like very famously, when a collector or a museum buys a Sollowit piece, what do they buy? Right? They just buy that certificate that has his signature on it. And that has the instructions on it. And some of those, you know, certificates also state specifically that, like, the certificate has to be, you know, present, you know, for it to be authentic. So this is another artist who, well, I mean, first of all, I think that he understood that the artistic value of his artwork, like, also needs to be reflected in like what it is that he's commodifying. He's saying that the instructions are the true artistic value, and he reinforces that by saying the instructions are the true financial value, right? Mm-hmm. The instructions are therefore also the commodity. So like that's a receipt that is art, right? And that we've accepted as art for 50 years, right? So that's pretty cool. you know, I mean, so that's just one example, right? And then I don't know to come on to the second part of what you were saying there about, you know, many artists, you know, jumping on the bandwagon who haven't kind of embraced what I think are like the artistic opportunities that are afforded by transacting art through non-fungible tokens. I'd agree with you. Like, you know, I would definitely agree with you. But to that, I just say that it's just like, it's early. You know, and so I just have a lot of optimism, you know, in just kind of communicating with people. One of the things that I try to do is like never hold it against anyone if they don't have an MFA, right? Mm-hmm. Like,
sure.
You know, on one hand, it means that, you know, maybe they've made better life choices than me. So that's deserving of my respect, right? no, but it's like, I'll tell you, it's just like, we're not seeing a lot of great conceptual art. Well, you know, I got it. Look, honestly, there was great conceptual art, you know, that has been made on blockchain. There really has. We're not seeing it dominate the marketplace just yet, right?
Yeah.
But I think that we'll see more of it. Like, look, right now, everybody's having fun. They're making their money, and that's fine. Go get it. That's, you know, I'd be very bitter of me to begrudge anyone that. But again, a lot of my experience and optimism comes from, yeah, some of the communities that embraced this token, like after all my friends at the initial drop. And like I said, it was like, yes, I had like some reach out from like real original crypto artists who are, I mean, brilliant and you know, but then, you know, I said, then it was like, you know, CryptoPunks people and, you know, these are like, and I was like humbled by their curiosity about the piece. And I had great conversations with them. And, you know, I think as the scene evolves, people will be looking for the next thing, you know, the next investment. Yeah, sure. But maybe like the next set of ideas that they find more enriching and rewarding and it'll happen, you know, or it'll not happen. And, you know, and then I guess, well, that's too bad, but people can do what they want.
I realize you should explain what CryptoPunks are because I actually don't know myself.
Oh, yeah. Okay, so CryptoPunks. Oh, sorry. So, okay, CryptoPunks are like the hot non-fungible token, right? And so they actually came out a couple months before the Digital Zone did. It's like 10,000. There are 10,000 of these avatars, all right? They're kind of low-resolution avatars, and they, you know, also had this idea of making, like, of making a cryptocurrency, all right, where each token would be like non-fungible and like uniquely identifiable and would be linked to ownership of one of these avatars, right?
Right, right.
And so this is like, you can't overstate how important like the CryptoPunks project was to establishing like the entire NFT market. Like, to put this in perspective, like there are many weeks, like if you look at the overall like trade volume, there's like all the NFT art on all the platforms, Super Rare, Foundation, Rarible, whatever. And it will sometimes all the other stuff like equals the trade volume just on CryptoPunks, right?
Right.
And so they, you know, unlike me, they didn't like deploy the contract and then kind of like walk away. They kept it up and they kept building this community. And now these avatars, you know, there's a strong community around them and they're traded as speculation and people like to use them as their Twitter handles and avatars and whatever. And you can't get one for less than like $40,000 now.
Wow. Yeah. Once you started explaining what it was, I was like, yeah, I think I've seen some of these for sure. And I'm sure people.
Yeah.
Have seen
it on Twitter. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. No, I'm not on Twitter, but I've seen them still. So the other question that comes to mind is, to what extent have you been financially benefiting yourself, not presumably directly, right, from huge sales, but indirectly, are you, you know?
No. It's great. It's so great. Yeah. So here's the thing, right? It was like I said, I set the token, the price of these, of the digital zones is hard coded into the contract. Okay. And, but they did. And actually this is even kind of a neat little, this is even a neat little like a homology or like way that Eve Klein is like analogous to what's happening in crypto art, right? The prices were on a bonding curve. that's a hot term right now in NFTs, which essentially means that like the first one sells for X dollars, the second one sells for 2X dollars, the third one sells for 3X dollars, right? So there's always incentive to get in there early. And Eve Klein sold his zones like this. And he said that there'd be 101 tokens and they would be released in eight different like series or tranches, right? And the first set of 31 would sell for this much gold, and the second set of 10 would sell for twice that much, and the third set of 10 would sell for twice that much still. So anyway, like I said, the 31 tokens in the series sold for 0.1 ether. And so whatever, and so they sold. So the total value of that in the contract now is probably worth like $8,000, right? But I need to make sure that the wallet always has enough money that if there's a bank run or a burn run, everybody can burn their tokens, right? And the contract still has enough money to throw half my money in the river, right?
Mm-hmm.
So theoretically, I could withdraw half the money, but I kind of like really don't want to because I think it looks bad for the people who believe in this artwork. It's like, well, he took out half the money. He could take out the other half, right? So I think it's probably best that I just let it be. I just add to my mystique by suffering for my art and not taking the money out of it.
Sure, but I'm just as interested though in like if there are any art schools that are adding blockchain, you know, education or classes or seminars, you know, or even positions to their schools, you would be like way at the front of the line or, you know, or even speaking engagements or what have you. I mean, is that kind of a thing or is it because you're not, you know, people, you don't necessarily have that demand?
I think that there probably like, you know, already were some, you know, professors who, you know, were teaching courses on this. Certainly like it wasn't a thing when, you know, I was in grad school or anything like that. But yeah, you have to imagine that every art school is trying to get, you know, a smart contract programmer in there, you know, as a, you know, at least as an adjunct or something like that, right? And so, you know, that may come up, and there will be certainly more qualified people than me to do that, but it'll be fun, and you know, be able to, you know, talk about it or do some workshops will be pretty fun.
Right. One of the premises or one of the motivations for your launching into this project was, what was the term you talked about? Modes of capitalism or something? Structures of capitalism? Was it something like that?
Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And so what do you think about structures of cultural capital?
Ooh, that's an interesting question. And it's really not something, I'll be honest with you, that is not a way that I've thought about my experience in this project. But, like, of course, it's, like, a valid and very interesting way to think about it. And in terms of – and it's especially interesting, I guess, considering the ways that, like, cultural capital and, like, influence capital is being, like, really rapidly, like I don't want to say redistributed, because I don't want to suggest that this is like a socialist way that we're, like, realigning our capital. But, you know, we were talking before about, you know, I'm never going to be like Beeple, right?
Yeah.
Never going to get my $69 million check from Christie's, right?
Right.
But that is all of a sudden, right? He is somebody, right, who has that creative capital that you're talking about. There is this kind of reconfiguration of the power structure that is, like, kind of going on here. And now the estate of Eve Klein maybe has some a lot of that type of capital you're talking about based on how much he's written about in history books.
Canonization.
How many museums he shows. Yeah, exactly. There's been an intense canonization, right?
Right.
And right now in this space, basically all capital has been distributed along the same lines as all creative capital has been distributed along the same lines as the normal kind of capital,
mm-hmm,
right?
Mm-hmm.
Like, this is, right, this is scary, maybe a little bit crazy, right? But Beeple has all of the creative capital, all of the attention capital, because, you know, his work got all of the capital, right?
Yeah. Well, wait, but didn't he had it before, you know, the auction? He already had quite a bit of that capital, even though people didn't know who he was outside of that space.
Yeah, it is true. He had like a million followers and stuff. But I think that once his NFT, like once NFT prices exploded, I think it's fair to say that the artists who wield the most influence and who are written about the most and talked about the most are also just the ones who are commanding the highest prices, right?
Yeah.
And this is actually very, very interesting because, you know, now I'm just thinking about it. Like, I really think that, you know, the NFT, it doesn't allow any new types of art, right? I think that blockchain allowed some new, maybe it allowed some new types of art, but the blockchain is just one implementation that doesn't allow a new form of art. It allows art to be a new form of commodity, right? And that's relevant. I think that is, you know, that can affect, like, the aesthetics of art. It can, like, affect, you know, ideas behind art or whatever. But, yeah, now to realize that, like, commodification and the ways that commodity is exchanged, like, is also the premise, like, that's also the basis on which we're assigning attention, right? Like, even critical attention, right? That's interesting. Maybe it is now just pure commodity. Oh, I don't know. I came into this with a lot of optimism.
Oh, no.
Kind of bent out of shape.
Oh, you got the conversation effect. I'm so sorry.
Oh, man.
Yeah, no, you know, stay optimistic. It's definitely a good trait to have. No, I think maybe you could, instead of bemoaning, maybe this can be, you know, another way to sort of explore, you know, a form of immateriality, like, which is to say, cultural capital, you know, and what those connections look like, maybe outside of what you one would expect? You know, is there anything that happens or has happened outside of what one would expect? Or is that just the nature of that thing?
The nature of
cultural capital, yeah. Money and attention. As in the examples that you were describing.
Well, no, because like before, and again, this is all super early, right? There have always been artists who have been like, you know, critically acclaimed and like in financially insolvent, right? Like,
right.
You know,
well, that's the Van Gogh effect.
Right. The Van Gogh, right. The Velvet Underground, right. Where like only 30 people show up to their shows or whatever. But, and I don't know, maybe that is happening here. I don't know. I try to, you know, but we just don't see it because everything is such a megaphone online and that's all you can hear. There are some people, you know, and I would like to count myself among them, who are trying to elevate and amplify like some of the, you know, conceptual art ideas, not just by myself, but by like others and people who came before me, kind of give them a platform and try to turn the scene onto them. I don't know. I guess we'll have to see how it goes. I think it's too early to get too pessimistic, and because we haven't yet seen how all the like social capital has played out. But yeah, right now the distribution doesn't look great. It does look like it's falling on exactly the same lines as right. The money capital.
Right, right. Yeah, and I have to just say before we wrap up that is a perfect analogy that you made. You know, because with punk, for example, a lot of the players, a lot of the important bands in that evolution, you know, led to Green Day, you know. Well, led to Nirvana to some extent, but really led to Green Day, who, you know, completely capitalized on that foundation that was built, right? So that's the analogy.
Right. Yes, it is the analogy. And here's what I would say, right? Is like we are very much like in the Green Day phase of of art on blockchain, right?
Uh-huh.
No, I mean, right, we are, and it's like, in the sense that, like, I think that, you know, there were early crypto artists, like, I'm looking at these books right now, and, like, I'm looking at these books, you know, published by Further Field, and I'm, like, looking at some of the artists that I was, you know, talking about, you know, just this week, like, with Sam Hard, and that was, like, you know, that was the Sex Pistols time, right?
Right.
And now, you know, the money's here, and we have the Green Day time. And that's fine. You know, maybe almost like, you know, like rap might be an even better example to say that, like, you know, we were like this is the MC Hammer Vanilla Ice time. And that there were which is to say, like, whatever, like there were good rappers in 1991 or whatever year that was. There really were, right?
Yeah.
We heard a lot of MC Hammer and Vanilla Ice. We did.
Right.
That's just what was on the radio. There were still good rappers, okay? And it's just like the Grandmaster Flashes, they sort of came a while ago, but, you know, rap music made it out to the other end, right? It made it out to the other end. And so this is my optimism, right?
Nice.
There's a lot of money and attention, and the attention is, you know, focused on, you know, a few players, and it's fine. It doesn't mean this thing is over, right? Rap didn't die in, like, 1991, and this has a lot of room to continue to grow and evolve. And there are good artists who are already here, and there are really good artists who actually have been here for a while.
Right, that's a great place to leave it on that optimism. thank you so much. It's been great talking to you.
I overcame the conversation effect.
You did, Mazel. Hey, and happy 420, by the way. Still 420 where you are too. Yeah.
Great call. Okay. Yeah. Well, look, thank you so much. It was really such a pleasure to talk to you. I'm a big fan of the pod.
Thank you,
Mitch. Thank you very much.
Yeah, of course. And we're out.